Hello and welcome to the Red Phone Zone. This is issue number 65. So here we are again. I am Aaron. I have with me Ethan.
Hello.
We also have, I think it's the Red Phone Zone first, where we have the same guest host 2 weeks in a row. It might be, might not be, but we have
We like him so much and whatnot. We decided not to let him go last week and kept him in a cage.
No. The guests are nice. We invited them twice.
You hosed them off once or twice, didn't you?
I thought you were doing that.
Oh, crap.
But it's Professor McGee.
Yeah, it's Professor McGee.
Christopher McLaughlin.
Yeah.
I'm not going to. I'm sorry. You're Christopher McGee because I don't sound drunk when I say it. But we got you back again this time.
Yeah.
And it's cool.
Well, good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea. And don't worry about sounding drunk when you say my name. It's a Scottish name. It inherently sounds drunk.
Well, I'm...
Good point.
I'm Scottish, and I'm drinking right now, so maybe that's why I sound drunk when it...
Good point, good point.
I've had, like, 3 sips of the beer, I'm fine. But yeah, we actually are doing something kind of, sort of, roundabout in a way special tonight. Because instead of talking a film genre, we are going to be doing the beta test on what we're doing after we ran out of genres, which is the directors. Mm-hmm. This time around, we are going to be discussing Ethan and Joel Coen as directors and their films, mm-hmm. and we're going to put together a list of our favorite films that they've made.
And even, it's sort of arguable anyway that Coen brothers are a genre in and of themselves, too. So.
Yeah, but...
There's some directors that are like that, though. So.
Yeah, but I'm not going to let somebody argue me into letting us talk Coens again.
Sure.
Well, you talked them as genres, not as...
Yes.
Uh-huh. But yeah, we're doing that, so we're going to see how it works. So it should be fun, because we actually had a nice long discussion last week about No Country for Old Men.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that we have some stuff to say about some Coen Brothers movies, so we're going to do that. But before we do any of that, we have a little segment we like to call Geekly Happenings. It's when we talk about news that's relevant to us geeks. What's happened in the last 7 days, Ethan?
A little, not a whole heck of a lot. I saw a report that Kevin Costner has appeared to have dropped out of Django Unchained due to scheduling conflicts. Variety reported that. So maybe no Kevin Costner in Django. I know last week we announced that Samuel L. Jackson, or week before, I don't remember. Samuel L. Jackson has been confirmed for it and all this other stuff. So there's that. And back in our... episode we did with Monty Cook, where we talked about time travel, one of the movies I really liked was Source Code.
Yeah.
Duncan Jones. Sorry. The Hollywood Reporter has brought word that CBS has Mark Gordon set to develop and Lost writer Steve Maida attached to write an episodic version of Source Code, which in the film allowed a military soldier, Jake Gyllenhaal, to repeatedly relive 8 minutes of the recent past in the body of another in the hopes of gleaning details that would prevent a future tragedy. The TV version is said to focus around 3 former federal agents who each participate in the Source Code program. The television series, unfortunately, for fans of the movie,
Jones?
No. He is not currently involved in the project. In fact, when he only learned of the television plans after the Hollywood Reporter published an article on it. So, which is too bad, but it could be an interesting thing. But I'm like going, okay, they've already done Quantum Leap. So,
yeah.
If you've seen that movie, he has a nod to Quantum Leap in it.
Yeah.
So, it was a big part of why he did that movie and whatnot. So, it was interesting. Let's see. Drive director Refn. I don't remember his first name for
Drive?
Some reason. Yes,
Nicolas
Drive.
Cage movie? No, that's Drive
yes.
Angry.
No, just Drive with Ryan Gosling.
Yeah. Okay.
He is he's hard at work. Actually, he's now attached to do Logan's Run, the Logan's Run remake that Bryan Singer was attached to forever.
Yeah.
The project would reunite the director with Ryan Gosling, who's the star of Drive, obviously.
Yeah.
Another unconfirmed project that has gained a lot of buzz is apparently from him is Wonder Woman, with Mad Men star Christina Hendricks, who also appears in Drive as the superheroine. Asked about the rumors, he explained that he was asked what would be his dream project, so he said Wonder Woman, and it built up from there. Then people asked who I would cast, and I said Christina Hendricks because she's the perfect woman. She's a great actress, and she looks like a woman should look. Okay. But Refn didn't rule out the film getting the go-ahead. There are some people saying, let's see how Logan's Run goes, and we'll take Wonder Woman from there. It's Hollywood, so you never know. So I think really what to get from this is he's working on Logan's Run. It's apparently one of his big dream projects. He's currently working on another movie with Ryan Gosling. So apparently he really likes to work with the same actors over and over again.
Ryan Gosling's not a bad actor.
No, he's really good.
He's a pretty good actor.
And there are some directors that did that, you know, and continue to do that.
Like Scorsese and DiCaprio.
John Ford, you know.
Ford and John Wayne. And,
you know, there you go.
Clint Eastwood and Morgan Freeman.
And James Cameron and Michael Biehn.
Yeah.
Speaking of James Cameron, actually, I did not intend to use that segue, now that I've ruined the whole segue by telling it's a segue. James Cameron apparently has been brainstorming for the next Terminator movie. Terminator creator James Cameron has been in a, quote, brainstorming meeting or two with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Justin Lin. It turns out that the main thrust of the report, though, is not, I mean, obviously, yes, they're meeting, they're trying to figure out what to do with the franchise, but Justin Lin apparently is being reported that he has to step down as director because of the proposed schedule would interfere with his commitment to making six times as Fast and Furious, which is the sixth Fast and Furious movie. God, why do we have six of those? I don't
know. People go see them,
but
dude.
People don't understand why.
Now, if I was a producer on the Fast and Furious movies, you could not stop me from making those movies.
Oh, no, I understand
they
that.
They make so much money.
The first one was awful, and the second was apparently bad, and I just didn't see any beyond that.
I didn't see the fifth one, but I saw the other four.
But apparently people love to go see him, and Justin Lin, who was formerly attached to direct everything.
We're not car guys, though.
Yeah, not really.
So
Justin Lin, who was attached to direct, like, everything, you know, like Highlander and all this, is now dropping out because of other commitments. He did hint that he would come back if the calendar works out, but it looks more likely that Terminator 5 will be looking for a new director.
I'll do it. How hard could it be?
I'd do it for half as much as he's getting paid.
How's there that? You go. How hard could it be?
Exactly. I thought this was interesting, but famed science fiction writer Harlan Ellison, who's in poor health right now, as he's, you know, ancient and has been around forever, wrote some classic Star Trek, City on the Edge of Forever, and, I mean, great sci-fi author and quite a jackass as well.
Cool.
He is in poor health, but he is still very adamant about defending his rights. He's filed a suit against New Regency and director Andrew Niccol and John Doe's to stop the release of the film in time, in which the suit alleges is based on Ellison's oft-reprinted 1965 story, Repent, Harlequin. Harlequin, said the TikTok man.
Yeah.
According to Hollywood Reporter, In Time, which stars Justin Timberlake, Amanda Seyfried, and Cillian Murphy, is scheduled for release on October 28th, and the suit alleges that both the story and the movie feature a timekeeper who keeps track of the remaining time allotted for people to live in a dystopian corporate future, along with other similarities, according to the report. So he's actually trying to block the release of the film, which is kind of interesting. Most of these... Again, this is one of those things that I'm like, okay, you knew this movie was coming out. Why'd you wait until now to do it type of thing? And
money,
and,
visibility.
Yeah, I know, but...
Oh, you're being ironic.
Are you asking why Ellison waited so long to file the suit?
Yes.
No. One thing you have to understand, okay, for someone who was a pre-media law for a while, it's notoriously hard to prove plagiarism. Mm-hmm. You need to bring in a truckload of evidence. It takes you almost to the day of really. It takes you forever to have anything that even in pretty slam dunk cases to have something that's going to beat the preponderance of an evidence. I'm not surprised it took him to the last minute. And let's not forget, Harlan's won a few of these before in his time. And
that is true. He win one for it was for City on the Edge of Forever. I know there's some litigation going on around that.
The most famous one is his suit against Terminator, and he won that. He won that eventually because he got his hands on a tape of James Cameron giving an interview to Starlog saying, "Oh yeah, well I got the idea by ripping off a couple of Outer Limits episodes."
Ah, okay.
So, I mean, Harlan is definitely a force of nature. I don't always love. Yeah. I don't always agree with him, but
I mean, he's got all his faculties. I mean,
he's like a.
And that's why, sort of, generally, when you see something like this coming around, you're sort of like, yeah, whatever. But I mean, the fact that it's Harlan Ellison, I mean, it's sort of like, oh, okay.
Alan Moore crazy is what it seems like to me.
Yeah, but the way our legal system is set up, it's far easier to get away with plagiarism than it is to prove it.
So, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I wouldn't read too much into the timing.
No. And I really don't think it's going to do much about blocking the release of the movie at this point, because it has been made and that sort of thing. But it might delay it. But I mean, it's all obviously over the money. So and something's going to happen. And we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, unless he's got another tape, he's not going to block release of this. You
know? Yeah. Exactly. I've got just some brief stuff. We've been talking some Expendables 2 the last couple episodes. They added Liam Hemsworth to the cast, which is a sort of a relative young newcomer.
He's Chris's brother.
There you go.
He was up for the role of Thor.
Well, there you go.
And he was Chris Hemsworth's top choice for Thor, because he said he thought he could do it better than him.
Alrighty. So. And this last weekend, The Lion King was number one at the box office.
How about that?
Again, making $29.3 million.
Right, you know, right the fuck on.
I know, that's really, you know, kind of amazing to me, especially how the last hand-drawn animation from Disney, or really hand-drawn animation, Princess and the Frog, fared. It wasn't nearly as good as this.
It was good, though.
It did okay.
I just mean good, like...
Sure. I'm saying, but
movie.
Financially, it didn't.
Yeah, no,
it didn't knock it out of the gate like this.
I didn't. I forgot about it. I didn't go see it. I mm-hmm. think we're gonna try to go this weekend with Chloe, sure. with Chloe, or next week. It's only out for 2 weeks.
I think so. Yes.
So
it's gonna be going for another week or so.
That I believe that showed up in my top six favorite films of all time. Maybe.
I believe so. Yes. It's a great movie. I love it.
If it didn't, then I know that Scar showed up in my top six villains.
Oh yeah.
So, but I love The Lion King. We keep on going back to this nostalgia thing, but I was 13 or 14 when it came out, and mm-hmm. I was really into Elton John at the time. Hmm. So, and then, you know, at the same time, it's Howard Ashman, and he did the music for Little Shop of Horrors, yet mm-hmm. another one of my favorite movies of all time. So I love that movie, and I understand the 3D is really good. So, cool.
Yeah.
I want to see it.
Yeah, Disney isn't one to do a half-assed job at something. So,
no, not usually.
I'm intrigued to see. I don't know if I'm going to get to see it go see it in theaters or not. I do want to pick up the Blu-ray.
Hold on. Disney doesn't want to do anything half-assed. Have you seen any of their direct-to-video sequels?
That's a Disney subsidiary.
Okay. Yeah, and
then we could also throw Miramax in that mix if we want to be like that. We're just trying to be nice about the funny little movies we were happy about when we were kids.
All right. But let's not go crazy giving Disney too much credit.
Well, yeah, I mean, they've done some fantastic things. They've done some, you know, horrible things. That's going to happen mm-hmm. with a 90-year-old company.
Yeah.
But, you know, overall, you know, like, I have confidence that the 3D will be good in that. I have confidence the 3D will be good when they re-release Phantom Menace. I don't want any comments on the state of Phantom Menace, but I'm sure the 3D will look good.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, because those people typically do really well with their effects and whatnot. So,
yeah. And looks like we've got three different iterations of Beauty and the Beast currently in the works. Two of them are TV series. The CW is planning a Beauty and the Beast series, as is ABC. Not a lot of info on that, although I'd imagine it'd be a modern take on them, given that the CW and ABC are generally not going for period shows. The thing that I found was interesting in here, though, is that there is currently Emma Watson is attached to headline in a film version to be directed by Guillermo del Toro.
Right on.
Which is intriguing, and I would see that.
Sure, me too.
Sounds pretty cool to me.
You watched the J. Edgar trailer?
I'm getting to that, actually. The last two bits of news I got is all Netflix.
You got that email, too?
No.
You didn't get the email?
No, I don't get their DVDs anymore.
I don't either, but I still got the email. But go ahead.
But first off, you know, Netflix obviously did their price hike and it went into effect.
Yeah, people are pissed about it.
And according to an article I read, they're going to be losing about 1 million customers because of that.
Yeah.
And I know they lost money on me because I downgraded to just streaming only.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are probably going that route. But then, sort of really out of the blue, Netflix decided to also split into two brands. Their Netflix is going to do only streaming service, and then they're going to have a new company called Quixtar, which is going to do DVD service and video games, apparently. Which
they should have been doing forever ago, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm sure Gamefly is ecstatic about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's probably going to bankrupt them.
Yeah, yeah. The only thing I can see as far as doing this is probably a business decision to probably leverage a bit better rights for their streaming service.
I have the email right here if you'd like to hear it.
Go right ahead.
It's a long one, but I'll. It says, you know, "Dear Aaron, I messed up," and I'm sorry. It's from co-founder and CEO Reed something or other. I can't read the rest of it. "Dear Aaron, I messed up and I owe you an explanation. It's clear from the feedback over the past 2 months that many members felt that we lacked respect and humility in the way we announced the separation of DVD and streaming and the price changes. That was certainly not our intent, and I offer my sincere apology. Let me explain what we were doing. For the past 5 years, my greatest fear at Netflix has been that we wouldn't make the leap from success in DVD to success in streaming. Most companies that are great at something, like AOL, Dial-Up, or Borders Bookstores, do not become great at new things. People want streaming for us. So we move quickly into streaming, but I should have personally given you a full explanation of why we're splitting the services, thereby increasing prices. It would not have changed the price increase, but it would have been the right thing to do. So here's what we're doing and why. Many members love our DVD service, as I do, because nearly every movie ever made is published on DVD. DVD is a great option for those who want the huge and comprehensive selection of movies. I also love our streaming service because it is integrated into my TV, and I can watch anytime I want. The benefits of our streaming service are really quite different from the benefits of DVD by mail. We need to focus on rapid improvement as streaming technology and the market evolves without maintaining compatibility with our DVD by mail service. Blah, 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 blah. So basically he's all like, oh, God, I'm trying to save face.
Yeah.
I have a question, and go ahead and, you know, throw the ignorant hat on me, but what limits their streaming service? What stops them from having every movie that they have available on DVD as streaming? Is there contracts
with the providers, and they don't want, essentially, film companies, rental houses, studios get pretty upset, and theaters get upset. Like when Night at the Museum, and it hit theaters like 60 days later, it was on DVD. That really pissed off theaters because they didn't have a big window to make money. And then the studio wants to have a rental window. And
that's a Disney thing, right? That was that Disney thing to where they have the 90 days from the theatrical release, there will be a DVD. I do remember something about that. Yeah.
And what it is it's a contract thing where they can only have certain titles showing up on their streaming service in order to continue to have their DVDs. And that's why I think it's a business split decision, is that if they have it as separate companies,
they can put more.
Then
on
Netflix
there.
Can just negotiate for the streaming stuff. And saying, well, we don't handle that anymore. That's this other company. They're, you know, yes, they're attached to us, but they're not us.
That's bullshit. I mean, when it comes down to it, I think call me completely wrong, but I think that if every movie that was available on DVD, was available for streaming, I think that less people would care about the DVDs.
Mm-hmm.
I know I would. I mean, like, that would be the only reason I would even consider thinking about the DVDs was because I can't get it on streaming.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's the studio is, it's like the music industry when Napster and whatnot came out, they just wanted to fight it.
Sure.
And so that's what studios are doing now, but they're just starting to sort of figure out that, oh wait, if we sort of embrace this and sort of mold the market to fit our mold, it'll work, you know?
Well, I know that, I mean, it's maybe a little bit unrelated, but I know that I saw this big petition signed by a lot of, you know, big filmmakers. I specifically remember Christopher Nolan being on there, and, you know, I have Scorsese, Spielberg, stuff like that, and they were they all signed a petition saying that they don't like the idea of It was in response to that that 90-day DVD thing. They said because when I make a movie, I make it for the big screen.
Right.
And you know, I want people to see it, you know, in, you know, my vision, not on a tiny little box and so on and so forth. And I think that's, you know, me personally, I think that's nice, and I think that's I guess admirable, but at the same time it's not very realistic. You know, especially the way the movie industry works, when you have a movie, you know, you get really lucky and you have a movie like Avatar that's gigantic and it's out for 8-10 months, whatever, in the theater, and then you have a really, really, really long life on DVD, and I think that they need to take that into account, that, you know, yeah, we want people to see this in the theater. Yeah, it'd probably be, you know, ideal, but unfortunately, a majority of the film's life is going to be on some sort of home viewing platform, personally, I thought.
It's, like I said, it's just the industry needing to catch up with technology.
Yeah.
And honestly,
I don't ever want DVD and Blu-ray to go away, though.
No, neither do I.
You know, I mean, I want that option.
Yeah, yeah, and I think, honestly, you know, it's one of those things. I think studios could look at streaming a bit better, as far as it's a heck of a lot more difficult to pirate, like your Netflix feed.
You can do it, though.
You can do it. Well, people are going to find a way around it anyway.
Yeah,
and then there's
it's really easy to pirate a DVD.
Yeah, and then there's the argument that the people who are pirating it wouldn't buy it anyway, and it's just one of those. One of those sort of gray areas that are out there. So
I don't know. You have any thoughts on it, Christopher?
Well, you know, honestly, I just got through reading an article about this very topic at the digitalbits.com. I believe it's their 920 update. That's, and
great website.
Yeah, it is. And I think I would just basically be reading that to people. So, I'll just say that the authors of that site echo a lot of my thoughts. So, you know, if you go to the Digital Bits and check the 920 update, I think they've got a lot of great things to say about the economics that are driving this and how, in a way, it's kind of a plunge off into a cliff, and nobody really, I don't think anybody's really thought through all the implications of this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
and it's the same thing that the music industry did when downloadable music started to pop up.
Yeah, it fucking sucks that, you know, Napster took it as bad as they did, you know, because, you know, they were just the first, and by far they weren't I don't even think they were the first. I just think that they were, like, the targeted one. And then now, I'm sorry, but it's so easy to steal any goddamn song on the internet, and it's fast. So, and it's, you know, it sucks, but, you know, that's just the way of it. I mean,
sure.
What are they going to do? Shut down the internet?
Yeah.
Nah, no. Probably not going to happen. Cool.
No, they don't have Oracle anymore to do that. So.
Damn it. What else have we got, Ethan?
Just some trailers hit. I spotted the trailer for a movie called 1911, which is Jackie Chan's newest movie.
Oh, okay, yeah.
And it's interesting to me that he's going more into some more dramatic roles. And this one essentially looks like Jackie Chan does The Last Emperor, but not from the Emperor's point of view. It's from the other side.
Cool.
So it looks cool. I mean, you know, stunning cinematography, et cetera, et cetera. So.
Yeah.
Clint fucking Eastwood's newest directorial outing is J. Edgar. The trailer hit with Leonardo DiCaprio. And
did you watch it?
Yeah.
Wow.
It looks cool.
Well, first off, it's going to be an interesting story. I don't know about you, Christopher. I am a fan of Leonardo DiCaprio, despite my best. I am.
Despite your best efforts.
Despite my best efforts.
He's really good.
He can be a very good actor.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I think in the last 10 years he's done a really good job of being a goddamn good actor.
Well, so. I mean, like,
he had to shed that whole Titanic teeny bopper,
you know. Yeah, the thing about it
but
is,
then Twilight happened and that all went away.
the thing about it is I've never ever thought of Leonardo DiCaprio as the guy in Titanic. I saw Titanic, I was aware of Titanic, but to me he was always that guy in Gilbert Grape that got fucked out of an Oscar.
Yeah.
And you know, and he was also on Growing Pains. So,
sure.
Yeah, I mean, that's the closest I think of I ever came to think of him as that.
I never really watched Growing Pains that much.
I knew him as the guy in Titanic,
and really working at the movie theater at the time, it was all the 12 and 13 year olds who were swooning over him all the time that got on my nerves. But the guy can act.
He can fucking act.
What's Eating Gilbert's Grape is good. I like that one. But the one movie that immediately comes to mind that I really, really liked him in was Catch Me If You Can.
Yeah, he was good in that.
I mean, I was like, this guy's good.
He's a real good actor.
I really think he gets a short end of the stick on a lot of things.
I do too. But I think that, and I'll he's gonna get an he will have an Oscar.
Well, it's because like the
and it might be for this.
Yeah, it might be. Well, the Aviator was one. I don't think he got nominated.
He
for
got
that,
nominated
did he?
For it. Yes, okay. He should have. Well, not should have, but he almost won it.
Mm-hmm.
But he Aviator really got fucked, and that's why Gangs of New York, or excuse me, not Gangs of New York.
The Departed
did as well as it did. I mean, sure. The Departed was a fine movie. It was a good movie, but sure. It didn't deserve all the Oscars it got.
Yeah.
And you know what? Dethroned The Aviator. It was Million Dollar Baby.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so well, yeah. I mean, yeah. I mean, it just
that's no slouch.
No, it's so. A good movie. It's a real good movie. Yeah. But I think it looks good, and he does not. You know, I'm looking at this picture, you know, like it's up on IMDb right now, picture of the trailer, and that doesn't look like he looks in the trailer, because he looks fat in the trailer.
Well, the movie obviously is going to follow him for a while, sure. And it goes back and forth. He's in heavy makeup.
Makeup looks incredible.
Mm-hmm. So, oh, yeah.
I'll see it, because I...
And on top of it, it's directed by
Clint fucking Eastwood,
so...
I love him as a director.
Not like he can direct at all. No, but wait, he can.
He's a very good director, I think.
Yeah, so that looks really cool.
I'll see it.
But obviously the best trailer that has come out in quite a while was The Pig with the Froggy Tattoo.
Yep.
Muppets trailer. Yeah.
I mean, I want them to keep coming out with these trailers, but, you know, they could have not released a trailer at all, and I'd be there.
Well, yeah.
I mean,
It's the fucking Muppets.
It's the fucking Muppets. I love the Muppets. And have you seen that one yet, Christopher? The Pig with the Froggy Tattoo, I think, came out yesterday or something.
No. It's
their parody trailer. It's great.
You know, I just have had very, very, very little use for anything Muppet since Henson himself died. I think there were 75 movies out in the 90s, and I never laughed at any of them. Muppets Tonight had its moments, but other than that, it's just like, wow. Sure. I hope I'm wrong.
I want this to be its triumphant comeback.
Myself. And those were the poor years for the Muppets.
Yeah,
the dark years. I remember the Muppet movie and the Great Muppet Caper, and I mean that's the late 70s, early 80s stuff. And,
yeah.
You know, back when the Muppet Show was going on. And,
oh yeah.
So and that's where my love of the Muppets come from, and this one sort of harkens back to that, and I'm loving it.
Yeah, to me it just. It looks like it could really, you know, be like that triumphant comeback for the Muppets, and I hope it is. I mean, because I think everybody needs a little bit more Muppets in their life.
Oh yeah, totally.
So, I mean, I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, being that or a Smurf sequel, I'm rooting for the Muppets, no question.
Oh yeah, totally.
Well, we're gonna get both.
Yeah,
of course.
Well, and Neil Patrick Harris is in both. So
Yeah. I saw the Smurfs, and it wasn't as bad as you might think, but that's hardly a stunning review. It doesn't suck that much.
It doesn't suck as bad as you might think.
You know, it's a fucking Smurfs movie. What do you want?
I've seen movies like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the kid loved it, so.
Hey, then, you know, it accomplished its mission.
Yeah, keep the
you
kid
it's,
quiet
It wasn't
for
meant for
minutes.
You and me. It was made for the little ones.
Yeah, and Frank Azaria was, or Frank, mm-hmm. Hank Azaria was pretty funny in it. But, you know. So, we got anything else?
Nah, let's talk some Coens.
No, that's...
Coens.
I'm ready to go.
Did you
want to
talk about Steven Spielberg getting yet another Oscar or another award? He's going to get the David O. Selznick Award at the PGA, the Producers Guild.
Oh, okay. Good for him.
Yeah, good for him. Yeah,
he doesn't have room on his mantle anymore.
I love
He's
Spielberg.
He's probably in the bathroom now.
I love
sitting
Spielberg,
on the top of the
but,
toilet.
Man, does that guy need any more goddamn awards? He gets it. He's a god.
He'd walk in. He's like glued them to the wall and using them as a hat rack.
Yeah.
That's totally what I'd do if I were him.
However,
and Dennis Muren too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Glue them all together in an odd form and say that's my Oscar sculpture.
Yeah, that'd be awesome.
I like this plan.
I think we should do it.
I think we should.
I like this plan, and I'm proud to be part of it. But there is a group of directors out there that are not overly laureled. They do have some Oscars, and they have some other awards, too. And that is none other than Ethan and Joel Coen, who we're going to be talking about after the break.
See them tumbling down. Pledging their love to the ground. Lonely but free I'll be found. Drifting along with the tumbling tumbleweeds.
And we are back. And like I said, this is our beta discussion about a certain group of directors, Ethan and Joel Coen. You can't have one without the other. This is going to work very similarly to the way that our genres discussion go, and we're just going to kind of talk about these directors, what they mean to us, kind of like what they are in a nutshell, and then we're going to get into our list of our top six or top ten, however you want to look at it, list of our favorite films that they've done. This is something that happened kind of, you call it organically, because we just had such a blast last week talking No Country for Old Men that we said, you know, we ought to just do a Coen Brothers show, and we didn't have anything else lined up, and we're lazy, so we said, hey, let's go for it. But I do know that I personally am a big fan of the Coen Brothers, and it sounds like Christopher is, and I don't think Ethan particularly
is. I like them more often than not.
Oh, I totally do myself. I often talk about, you know, top six lists that we've done in the past that I regret the way they went, and one of them was my top six favorite directors, because I probably should have had the Coens on there, because just as much as I like them.
With the Coens, for me, the reason I say it's, you know, more often than not I like them is when they're on the ball with me, they do great stuff. Mm-hmm. But when they're off the ball, they do stuff that I just can't stand.
And to me, they've only got one movie I can't stand, and at the same time, there's like three or four that, you know, that I'm absolutely enamored with, which is more than I could say about any other directors. I mean, there's hardly any directors that, you know, have like that many good movies in their filmography that I just think are like as stellar as the Coen Brothers. And it'd be weird. Like, imagine E.T. landed on this planet and us trying to explain who the Coen Brothers were to them. I mean, yeah, you can say, yeah, they're filmmakers, but I don't think that covers it. Because, yeah, they are filmmakers, but calling the Coen Brothers filmmakers and calling, you know, Justin Lin filmmakers, I mean, it just doesn't seem like the correct description.
Sure.
Because, you know, they make movies, but the only real, other than, like, you know, some of the, like, the same performers or, you know, cinematographers, junk like that, the only real connecting
factor
is sometimes some nihilism. I mean, a definite quirkiness.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
sort of why with me, it's their movies. Quirky is a good way to sort of describe it. Is they're really hard to fit into a genre, really hard to fit into a box.
Other than the Coen Brothers.
Yeah. Other than it's a Coen Brothers movie, and there are movies out there. It's like, well, it's kind of like a Coen Brothers movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
And whereas these guys, I think the fact that they do some of these oddball movies like that have sort of this quirkiness, this sort of edge to them. For me, it's because of that they're walking on this edge that they can either nail it or they just fall flat for me.
See, and I mean, I don't want to keep going there, but, you know, they've really only got one movie that I'm not a huge fan of. But I think I said this to both these guys off the show, but sure. I really feel like this list, you know, I think we talked a little bit last week on air that, you know, the list we'd made last week, you know, suck because it was so hard to do. I had a much harder time with this list because there are some severe sins of omission on this list. I've left movies off that I love.
Yeah.
But, you know, because I just, A, because of the sake of the conversation, because, you know, I put some in here that I have a suspicion will not fall on these other guys' lists.
Sure.
But, you know, at the same time, I just, you know, like, I really love a lot of these movies.
And with the Coen Brothers, they have such, they have this quirkiness, but they do such a different type of film each time. I mean, they did True Grit, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
and they did Fargo,
there's Fargo, there's True Grit. I mean, these are Coen Brothers movies, but they're in no way are they similar types of genres or similar type of, you know.
My absolute favorite turnaround that they ever pulled off in their career was when they went from No Country for Old Men to fucking Burn After Reading. Yeah. I mean, that was so weird and perfect, and it's like one of those times that it's fun to look at these things from atop the fourth wall. Mm-hmm. You know, because it's like, you know, the fucking guys that gave us Anton Chigurh gave us the same fucking movie, and it's nothing like that movie, and it's not nearly as great, but it's good in its own way, and it's crazy. Christopher, I know that you're a fan of these guys, and what's up with that? What's up with that? I mean, like, why? I mean, I have a hard time. To me, I just find them, I find them unique, and I think that's the main thing I like about them. What is it for you?
Well, to me, first of all, you just simply have to acknowledge the obvious and that they're tremendously talented artists. I mean, to me, I don't know how you could call yourself a true fan and not appreciate at least the bulk of their work just because they're such genuine talents.
Sure.
But, you know, there are a lot of filmmakers who I respect as craftsmen. We were talking about Steven Spielberg earlier. I think Spielberg is one of the most naturally gifted directors ever.
I do too.
But without sounding corny, I think the Coen brothers take it to another level.
They do. Given that
they write, direct, produce, edit, I think they're in the realm of a genuine artist. Mm-hmm. And I think their films, in addition to being marvelously entertaining and unique. I you see some really distant influences like Preston Sturges, depending on the specific film. But all in all, just tremendously unique and with a tremendous point of view. I mean, they're the type of films that you think about days, months, weeks, years after you've seen them. And, you know, I mean, I think it was Kevin Murphy that said that, you know, the problem with cinema today is there are far too many, well, that was okay films being made.
I couldn't agree with that more. I would rather hate a movie than think it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I would like to think the Coen brothers would be appreciated in pretty much any era, but the fact that they are flourishing in an era where the quality of films has noticeably deteriorated, you know, it just makes that's like, you know, the old Dennis Miller line about, you know, the black velvet that reveals the cubic zirconium.
Yeah.
You know, they show as a true diamond surrounded by so much zirconium.
Yep.
Sure.
I mean, it's go ahead, Ethan.
No, and I think you can arguably say that they're the ones who sort of invented the what one considers to be the independent film that you think of today.
Yeah, kind of, sort of.
It's when you're talking about the diamond and the zirconium, it's, you know, really for me, it's apples and oranges. I can't imagine anyone thinking, you know, of comparing something like No Country for Old Men and
Raising Arizona.
even within the Coen brothers stuff is comparing one movie to another, and there it's like these are the same direct, that's really kind of weird. But I'm saying, even just in that same type of, you know, time period, you know, it's like you have No Country for Old Men and, you know, Cowboys and Aliens coming out, you know, within a couple of years of each other, and it's like they're apples and oranges, you know.
I mean, I when I think of the Coen brothers, I mean. You know, I think of, how do I put this?
They're so off the wall.
They're very off the wall. But a thing, you know, I keep coming back to that, you know, that boring adjective when I just think that they're original. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's because, like, you know, like look at a director like Martin Scorsese.
The adjective I'd use would be fearless.
Well, really. Sure. There's
because they're not really afraid to go against convention and or you know, kill Brad Pitt. You know, I mean,
right.
I remember watching Burn After Reading and going, fuck.
That's
you know,
yeah.
It's something you don't expect out of, you know. It's like, well, they've got the big star. Obviously, the big star is going to be Hank, or not.
Yeah,
okay,
maybe,
then you know.
Not.
So
yeah. I don't know. It's just like my thing about, and I'm trying to think of a good way of making an analogy out of this, and apparently I suck at analogies. But you know, I want to look at a director like Martin Scorsese, let's say, and you know, I think he's a really good director, and I like a lot of stuff he does. But I also think that if you've seen, you know, like one of his gangster movies, one of his crime movies, and you've seen them all, in a nutshell.
I agree.
I don't think you can say that about the Coen brothers, even their comedies. You know, you look at something like Raising Arizona, or The Big Lebowski, or Burn After Reading. Those are all three part of like the same genre. They're nothing alike.
Yeah, and even to the point where if you don't know that the Coen brothers did this movie, you go,
I'll figure it out.
It's like, well, it's like, you know, you go and you see Fargo. You know it's a Coen brothers movie, but then you turn around and see Intolerable Cruelty again. It's not obvious that that's a Coen brothers movie, you know.
I approved this one with myself because, you know, I long said that I think that if I was watching a Coen brothers movie and I didn't know it, I would know it before it was over.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened to me with Lady Killers. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that was a Coen brothers movie. And, mm-hmm. I was all the way through, I'm like, damn, this seems like a Coen brothers movie. And then at the end, you know, directed by Joel and Ethan Coen. I'm like, well, no wonder it seemed like a Coen brothers movie.
Sure.
And I think that's cool that they have, like, I think that's cool they have just,
like,
such,
like,
a
well,
stamp.
Hot damn.
You know, either I'm good or they suck, you know, one or the other, and I think I must be good. But I don't know. I mean, I feel like I'm you know, I'm talking about them as a whole isn't really doing them much justice. So I think we need to get into our list and start talking about our you know, individual films. We could talk about this, you know, more directly, unless you have something to add before we get into the list, Christopher.
I think we're pretty much already talking about individual films, so I think maybe, yeah, you're right. We should get onto the list. Right.
I mean, because it's hard to talk about, you know, the umbrella of them. Let's just talk about the individuals. That's what makes them so cool, and I guess that brings us to Ethan's number six.
All right, when I sat down and I made this list, I basically listed out all of the Coen brothers movies I'd seen, and it ended up being 13 of them. So.
And they directed 15 or 16?
Yeah, I'd seen more than I thought I had, which sort of goes in more into what we were talking about. It's like you can... Really, for me, it's like I could see a movie and not really real. Yeah. I personally can realize not really going in that you're going to see a Coen Brothers movie. It's you know, you're expecting one thing, but you can get another. So what ended up at number six for me was just sort of process of elimination ended up being The Big Lebowski.
That's my number six as well, and I'm amazed that it showed up. I thought you can't stand that movie, can you?
It's not one of my favorites, no.
See,
but I like it more than... other movies they've done.
Sure, me too. And I think I keep wanting to say it was Christopher where we had this conversation on Facebook about The Big Lebowski, and I don't remember if it was him or somebody else, but the thing about The Big Lebowski is I like it. I like it quite a bit. I think it's a really funny movie. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot of really unique stuff about it. I that's like one of the very few movies I've actually read the screenplay for. Mm-hmm. And like the dudes, you know, Jeff Bridges, the dude's dialogue has all the ums and okays and mans and stuff like that that you would think would come across as a, you know,
as an ad lib.
Sure. But no, every single one of those little nuances was actually in the script. And I like a lot of the stuff they do with that movie, and the fact that you have, you know, Lebowski, you know, the dude, Jeff Bridges' mm-hmm. character is, you know, your atypical layabout stoner. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he's not, you know, like, hey, man, peace, man. He spends the whole movie fucking pissed off and aggressive and, you know, doing all the stuff that you don't think of as a stoner. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really like the movie for its own merits. One thing I do not like about the movie, and, you know, call me an asshole for saying it, I don't like the huge fans of it because I feel like they don't get it.
Sure. And for me, it was the huge fans that sort of colored my perception of it.
Yeah.
And, It is a movie I say that I think I've seen only once.
I've definitely seen it multiple times.
And it's for me at this point, and the one time I saw it was more than 10 years ago at this point. And it's something I think I should watch again.
It's not on Netflix anymore, but no, it was for a very long time.
Right. But it's one of those things that I should probably watch it again with the washed mindset of I had enough people going, oh, it's the funniest damn movie, blah, blah, blah. And you know, things like that colored my perception of it. And I was like, it's not, and it's one that I think you just need to sit down and watch. And it's one of those movies, I think, that really shows how good Jeff Bridges is, you know, and a lot of people until recently really sort of underrated him a lot.
And I agree with that. One of the things about The Big Lebowski that, you know, I do think it's a funny movie. There's definitely, you know, funny parts in it. I love how the Coen brothers, you know, I'm going to use the term again. Apparently, I only have so many adjectives that fit in my big stupid head. But, you know, they're really good at straddling the fourth wall because of the in-joke in the movie with Donnie, Steve Buscemi's character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the whole thing is, shut the fuck up, Donnie. Shut the fuck up, Donnie. Shut the fuck up, Donnie. And he barely spoke. And the reason for that was Steve Buscemi had been in several Coen Brothers movies before that, and those movies, and he was a very talkative guy that wouldn't shut the fuck up. And so in The Big Lebowski, you had the Steve Buscemi character is totally being told to shut the fuck up all the way through it, and he's barely saying a word.
Right.
And, you know, I like that kind of self-referential humor.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy this movie. I don't think that you're ever going to be able to like it. It's just not an Ethan movie. But at the same time, it's...
But I'm willing to give it another shot and watch it.
It's worth it.
I mean, it made it up to number six in my movie. That's why it shows the real wide spectrum for me with the Coen brothers.
Yeah.
And while this one ends up more or less at the middle of my list, you know, so.
My thing about it is it's a fucking weird movie, but... And it's something that cannot be said. I cannot stress this enough. I have given up on Coen Brothers movies as single viewings. No, mm-hmm. never going to happen. Never going to happen. There's not a Coen Brothers movie that's ever going to come out where I'm not going to see it multiple times. Because, like, there's several movies on this list that, you know, my respect for them grew the more and more and more I saw it. And, like, you know, one of them is this. I mean, this is one, you know, I watched, I'm like, what the fuck is everyone reacting to? And then, you know, the more I see it, the more I can kind of get it, but sure. I don't like the people that claim to be huge fans, or even if they are, I don't think they get it. You know, because I think they think of it as a pop movie, and I think it's exactly the opposite of that,
mm-hmm.
personally.
And yeah.
Now, is this something that you feel the need to talk about, Christopher, at all?
It's later on my list, so I'll defer.
I do enjoy it. I think it's a good one. And I guess that brings us to your number six.
Oh, mine. Yeah. Okay. Well, I have to get off to a rather lame start with this one because I tried to rank them in the order that I love them. I thought that seemed to
it's
be
so hard,
enough.
Isn't it?
Yeah, and then just I wound up being shocked by how low some things are, and yep. it's like, wow, I simply must adore that film higher than that number. But mm-hmm. this is kind of the first vibe I get on that because six for me was A Serious Man,
and
they're really they're,
and that's one I haven't seen.
I don't have enough words to describe how much I adore that film. So if I can, as best I may, explain why it only checks as number six, because of all of their films, it's the one that I have found a lot of things to love in there because, you know, it's grappling with serious moral issues. I mean, it's basically a retelling of the Book of Job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, seriously, imagine anybody walking into a major studio, I want to shoot the Book of Job.
Yep.
You know, I mean, seriously, they'll throw, you know, you want to get the whole syllable out. So it's just such a daring idea. And it's an explicitly moral film. I mean, it may not be a morality that we choose or we even agree with, but it's such a it's talking about, you know,
so weird
the Jew, you know, there's that strong Jewish element to yeah. it, obviously, in that time and place, and talking about the way that that Jews see the world. I mean, there just aren't that many films being. I mean, isn't the whole plot of For Your Consideration about how they have to strip the Jewishness out of it so that everybody can go see it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, that springs to mind. And the fact that you're laughing so hard
at this poor guy,
this man's life completely coming apart for no justifiable reason.
Yeah.
And I actually would feel bad about spoiling the ending. But all I can say is that's an ending that will, I mean, it's yeah. been, geez, 2 years since I first saw that movie, and I'm still grappling with the ending.
Yeah. I mean, do you, it's one of those things where, do you really want to, I mean, yeah, I'm kind of with you. I don't really want to spoil it too much, but do you really want it to go the way you think it's going to go? And but if it isn't, what does that mean? And what, you know, it's one of those movies that makes you
think.
Do I
need to leave the room so you guys
No, yeah. not really, because I don't want to really spoil it, because it's, I mean, that's one of those endings I can see, like, you know, so many people taking so many different, variations on it, people thinking,
yes.
you know, taking their own endings with it. This is my number seven, and, you know, I really, 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 really enjoy this movie, and I actually it honestly felt to me more like a number six, but I thought I was going to have to talk Big Lebowski, because I thought Ethan hated it, and I didn't think, I thought I remembered you didn't like it, but no, I really like it, and it's one that I've only seen twice, and I do want to see it again, and it's just such a weird yeah. movie. I mean, I can't really put,
yes.
I can't make it, I mean, that's such a disservice to it, but that's really my best explanation for it. It's weird.
Yeah.
But it's
good.
It's a really good weird.
But it's weird in the sense that there's really nothing like it. It's not like yeah. Eraserhead weird. We should be clear on that,
yeah.
that I think.
Yeah.
But, and, you know, and honestly, once I've had a chance to actually, I think, sit down and reach an accommodation with what I think the film is about, it will probably go higher on the list. But I'm just, right now it's at six just because I'm unsettled as to what I make of it. Other than, you know, but there's enough in there that I love. It's six just on that alone.
Yeah, sure. it's one of the Coen Brothers movies that I've seen the least. But mm-hmm. I need to pick it up on Blu-ray or DVD or something like that, because I mm-hmm. really, really, really enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good choice. I liked it a lot.
Thank you.
I liked it a lot. And my number six was The Big Lebowski, so that brings us down to Ethan's number five.
Well, my number five is a movie that I guess you either get it or you don't, and it is the one that I'm pretty sure Aaron hates with passion. It is Intolerable Cruelty.
I want to see it again, because that is the one I've only seen once.
And for me, I sort of get it. It was the Coen brothers doing a, you know, 50s, 60s style romantic comedy. It was them saying, we need a Cary Grant, Grace Kelly type of movie. And here we go.
And I remember watching it, and I have not seen it since it just came out on DVD. I'm pretty sure I rented it the day it came out on DVD, and I haven't seen it since. But I remember my impression about it being is like, all these characters are such pieces of shit. Why am I supposed to care about them?
Sure.
And that was my reaction to it. But I do want to see it again because it's the Coen brothers.
And for me, I liked it because it had that great, you know, classic romantic comedy element or feeling to it. And I remember watching it just going, you know, he really is sort of, you know, George Clooney really is sort of channeling Cary Grant in this movie. And you know, but it's set in the modern context. And, you know, there's some great chemistry. And it's, you know, usually I don't go for movies like that. And for that movie, I was, it had me, you know, it had me at the beginning.
You just liked it because Bruce Campbell was in it.
Hey, Bruce Campbell generally makes everything good, but I have seen Assault on Dome 4, and that didn't work. But I liked Intolerable Cruelty.
I need to see it again.
It was, for me, an entertaining fun. It's one of those movies that, for me anyway, it didn't feel like a, quote, Coen brothers movie.
And maybe that's it. Because, like,
and, yeah.
You know, the thing about the Coen brothers movies is there are several of these that I've done a 180 on. And sure. I didn't like them at first, and then, like, I walked away from it curious. And then, you know, it made me go back to them and... You know, okay, I get it. You know, I different levels of like.
And
this one, I walked away with no curiosity.
Yeah, this I can definitely
put it
say
out of my mind.
If you had shown me this movie beginning to end without showing me the credits or anything like that and masking all that, I would not have been able to tell you it was a Coen Brothers movie.
I would, you know, I'm just so unfamiliar with it, I can't really say.
Sure. But I really liked it. You know, you had sort of this old Hollywood regal feel to it that really sort of struck a chord with me, and that's why it reached number five on my list. So,
cool.
That's why I liked it.
Cool, Christopher.
Well, it didn't make my top 10, but you know, there's nothing wrong with the Coens occasionally just being really clever and riotously funny. But
sure.
Their films sort of break down into two categories for me.
Mm-hmm.
They're the films that you wind up quoting for years afterward.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, I still use that Tenzing Norgay thing, you know, any chance I get.
Uh-huh.
And then there are their films that you quote forever and that you also continue to find new layers of meaning to. And obviously,
right.
Intolerable Cruelty isn't like that. But, and again, I'm sounding like I hate it, and I don't. I mean, I would watch Intolerable Cruelty over 95% of the films ever made. But
like you're saying, it's one that they do movies that you can take away from. I think this one isn't meant to be like that.
It's a testament to the Coen brothers, though.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because, you know, this is one of those, I mean, I think that if I did a top six, you know, hated movies list, I think that Intolerable Cruelty would probably hit that list for me. And, you know, there's some movies on that list that you know, that are so bad to me that I will dismiss the entire filmography of, you know, the director or the actor or whomever is so responsible for them. Doesn't do it to me. I'm just saying, you know what, they've got 16 movies, and I think 15 of them are incredible fucking movies. You know, I'm going to let them have this one.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I do want to see it again because it's the Coen brothers, and I wasn't as big of a fan of them then as I am now, and maybe multiple... It's got Jeffrey Rush in it, right?
Yes.
I thought so. It wasn't,
yeah.
He was, like, in the first scene.
Yeah, it's been forever since I saw it, but... It's definitely a testament, I think, to the Coen brothers. The way they can make a movie. They can make the movies that you say, oh, that's a Coen brothers, typical Coen brothers, quote unquote movie. But then they turn around and do something like this that I think is much more could be considered much more a mainstream type of a movie.
Yeah.
But still, you know, they turn it around and are able to do something good with it. So
sure.
Whereas generally a mainstream movie like that isn't something I'd go see or something I'd want to see and or something I'd like. They actually did a good one with this one for me. So.
Yeah. Cool. Excellent. And I guess that brings us down to your number five, Christopher.
Well, that's where Big Lebowski came in for me.
Okay.
And this was the one film of theirs that it doesn't really have much of a larger meaning to it. Sorry, those of you that have converted to dudeism.
I cannot agree with you more, man. I think it's a really fun movie for what it is, but some people just don't get what it is.
But I will say this much for it. Okay. First of all, it is obviously one of those where they're just being monstrously clever.
Yep.
And I don't know that they've ever been more clever in that. I don't think they've written a funnier film, and that's got to count for a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, you know, it harkens back to what I consider one of their strengths is their ability to take classic Hollywood formulas and take them in directions that nobody could have possibly thought of. I mean, putting a 60s burnout slacker into a Raymond Chandler mystery.
How cool
right
is
down
that?
To the fact that it doesn't, you know, the fact that the mystery doesn't really make all that much sense.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what to me puts it over any of the other films they've made that are just simply clever. Again, I think this is the king of the clever pile. But here's the thing. Just when you think that film has shown you, you know, okay, we're clever, we're aping an old Hollywood form, right at the end, they get some genuine pathos out of the relationship between Walter and the dude.
Yep.
The scene at Donnie's funeral where, you know, where Walter just breaks down and apologizes to the dude and hugs him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really, you know, I mean, that's, I mean, really, I mean, that the film would have been extraordinary even without that whole closing scene. But I think that takes it to another level. The fact that they're willing to inject some genuine feeling for these outrageous characters on top of it all. You know, I mean, I think that puts it in a class of itself, even though, like I said, it's not really about anything.
No, I mean, it's about nothing. I mean, no, I don't want to steal the Seinfeld idea, but it really is. I mean, it's about this really oddball couple of days with this weird guy. But, you know, weird shit happens to weird people, I guess. No, I do enjoy it, and I think Ethan and I talked it up quite a bit.
Yeah.
So, cool. I guess that brings me down to my number 5.
Affirmative.
All right. My number 5, let me make sure. I'm pretty sure I know what it is. Yep. My number 5, I actually have already mentioned it kind of tangentially, but it's 2008 Burn After Reading. And what I said before, with the whole, one of the things I really dug about it was this is their follow-up to No Country for Old Men. Mm-hmm. And I shouldn't take that into it, but for some reason I can't stop myself from doing it. It's just such a ludicrous movie.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I mean, it's one of those movies that I really enjoy watching with people. I love showing it to people.
It's one of those movies that you go, yeah, that's a Coen Brothers movie.
Oh yeah, without a doubt.
Yeah, and it definitely does, you know, goes against conventions, and you know, it has that oddball quirkiness and weirdness to it that's kind of endearing. And
yeah,
I mean, it fell on number 8 on my list. And really, the thing that I loved in the movie was
I like fucking with convention in it. That's what I liked about it.
As far as actors in the movie, I mean, what I loved in it and was the. Honestly, was someone who wasn't in it very much was J.K. Simmons.
I love J.K. Simmons,
and really
he
just came down
me up in
just
that movie.
Came down to the end with him, where like, he's just like, no, of course not, no, fuck no,
fuck it, no, get rid of
fucking
no.
it, fuck it, get rid of it, and do this.
Yeah,
and I just love his sort of what, fuck no, you know, I just love his attitude.
God no, fuck
oh,
no,
God no.
Yeah, like I said, I love seeing it with people. Because I love seeing people's reaction to Brad Pitt getting shot. I'm sorry, guys. Spoiler.
Oh, yeah.
Man, I've seen a lot of reactions to a lot of movie theaters. And, you know, to a lot of different movies, to a lot of different scenes. And that's, like, one of the top reactions I've ever seen to people. I mean, you see, you know, the Sixth Sense with the big reveal at the end. And you hear all the, you know, the kind of the mummering and shit. But I've never seen a theater just tense up as bad as they did when, you know, they took you in this movie and they made you comfortable, I guess is the best word for it. It's like, okay, I get it. This is
it's like, this is a silly comedy.
This is a silly comedy caper.
Yeah.
And then you have this.
And the Coens do that a lot in their movies. They try to make you comfortable and then they snap you out of it.
Yeah. Brad Pitt is playing this lovable idiot.
Yeah.
I mean, well, you know,
he's a doofus.
He's a doofus. He means no harm. He's obviously in way over his head. And you're thinking, okay, you know, ha ha ha. And then George Clooney just blows his fucking head off just out of nowhere. And it's just such an amazing scene because it makes you take.
And even in the same way, George Clooney's this putz in the movie, too,
yeah,
you know?
George Clooney's always a putz in Coen Brothers movies.
Yeah.
He calls them his dumbass trilogy or something like that. I don't remember his exact terminology,
sure.
But something like that. And then, you know, it makes you say, what the fuck am I watching? Then, you know, they just killed, you know, it's like they killed a puppy or something.
Yeah.
I mean, he's so innocent, so sweet, and an idiot, and you never kill the idiot. And they killed the idiot, and they killed him horribly and callously. And and then it just goes in all these directions that you would never, ever expect it to. And it's obviously not, like, the most biting social satire in the world, but I enjoyed it, and I really enjoyed it. Probably more than I needed to for it being a follow-up to something like No Country for Old Men. So
yeah.
That's why it's my number 5. I mean, did it fall on your list anywhere, Christopher?
I missed my top 10 because it's, I mean, it's got some extraordinarily funny bits in it. I mean, there's some, again, geez, can we just say they're all quotable and just get that out of the way?
Yeah.
But I tell you, it didn't make my top 10 because we had a Coen Brothers Film Festival here at my house over the weekend. That was one of the films we screened.
Yeah.
And it just, seeing it for, I guess that was my third or fourth time seeing it, just how uneasily some of the tonal elements lie mm-hmm. next to each other.
Yeah.
See, and as funny as the Brad Pitt character is, he just sort of, he just sort of grates up against some of the other characters because, like, you know, you have George Clooney who's essentially playing himself.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. how I kind of picture George Clooney's real life is, right down to the hobby.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that.
Okay. And then you know they're these basically these ridiculous you know funny character people, and then they throw in characters that have a genuine pathos to them, like the Linda Litsky character.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I mean of all the really sad tragical people there are out there, there's the woman with a lot to offer. It's just, you know, she may be in her 40s, and for mm-hmm. that, you know, she's much more lonelier than she ever deserves to be. Mm-hmm. And really, is there anything sadder than Linda's boss at Hard Bodies?
Yeah, Richard Jenkins. That's what I was gonna say. I mean, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right about the pathos there, but I'll give you one more. And I think that the tragedy of the story is Richard Jenkins' character. You know, because that guy, you know, I mean, I felt so bad for that guy. And
yeah.
But you know, I don't know. I found it to be an enjoyable movie. So,
see. Oh, well, again, you know, the worst Coen Brothers film I would watch over 95% all films ever made. But this is one where I don't think the ingredients quite gel.
And for me, the reason it sort of ended up lower on my list was that for me, it's a fun movie to think about and go, yeah, I did see it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. But other than Brad Pitt getting shot in it, there's no real big memorable bit in it. You know,
oh, come
there's
on.
Nothing.
J.K. Simmons? I thought everything he did in that movie was memorable.
No, I think he's hysterical. But what I'm saying, though, is comparing it to their other movies, there's no like, do you remember this one scene? Oh, my God, there's this, you know, oh, it's so good. And that. But in this one, it's just, you know, it's like, it's sort of, for me, what I'd explain it as, it's their cigarette after No Country for Old Men.
Exactly.
It's like, all right, we're done with that. Let's just, we'll smoke that, and all right, now what's next?
Kind of like a weird little aside about this movie. You know, it doesn't really have much to do with, like, you know, how good or poor or whatever of a movie it is my parents went to go see it for God knows fucking why. I think they're all like, I know who Brad Pitt is. I know who George Clooney is. And to hear those two talk about it, man, they hated this movie. I mean, and they for some reason they especially took offense at Malkovich's character about how he swore so much.
Oh, yeah.
And like they also couldn't stand Linda Lipsky because, you know, she went on that date with that horrible guy.
And I had actually just forgotten that Malkovich was
Malkovich was funny in that.
Yeah, I know, but I had forgotten he was even in it. So this sort of goes into why, you know, I just don't think it's as memorable a movie as they've done. So
I don't know. I mean, they went on with this. My parents went on this tangent about the whole scene or what. Scene where she went on that first date with that loser, and he was just being, you know, wasn't laughing at anything, and like whatever, and of course she fucked him, and they're just going off and just like how horrible of a movie this is, and they'd seen it before me, and I'm like, this sounds fucking awesome. And I went and saw it, and I'm like, yeah, that movie was, I liked that movie, that was cool. But
you know, they're at most two Coen Brother films I'd show to my parents, so I salute their adventurousness.
I mean, nice. I they did not know what they were walking in. Yeah.
Okay.
That's one of the fun things about it to me. But you know, I enjoy it. I thought it was fun. So I guess that brings us down to Ethan's number four.
Right? Yeah, I believe so. Well, my number four is one we've talked about at length before. It's No Country for Old Men. You know what more?
It's my number.
Really,
three.
Yeah, I mean, what more can it really add to it? You know, I mean, for me, this movie is in the performances more than anything, and
to me, it's the everything of this movie. I mean,
well, it's definitely one of those I think masterpieces that the Coen Brothers have managed to put together, where they wove some great elements and some great actors into a great story to tell just a very highly, just a highly just painted type of movie. You know,
I did watch this right after last week's show.
Yeah, and it's highly interpretive. You know, I mean, you could go in different directions, and you can sit and analyze that movie for hours upon hours, and go in depth into a film class with it. And, yeah.
I'd love to go to that class.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those movies that is just, you know, they just nailed it on all fronts with it. So, yeah.
I've got literally nothing negative to say about it. I mean, like, you know, some of my favorite movies of all time, I can be all like, yeah, I love this movie, blah, 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 but I could have dealt without this. Mm-hmm. That this movie does not have that for me. I mean, sure. I mean, this movie is the whole picture. Yeah. I mean, I love it. I love the story. I love the acting.
Sort of like with other Coen Brothers movies, well, they're known for the black comedy type of thing, is, you know, where, you know, like in Burn After Reading, Brad Pitt gets shot. There's a point after that where you still even chuckle a little bit.
Oh, sure.
But this movie, I don't think there's really any chuckling going on in this movie.
But I feel bad about it. You know, because, you know, I'm kind of laughing in a really uneasy way in the gas station scene.
Sure.
Because, you know, like, you know, this is a fucking ridiculous situation, but at the same time, it's deadly.
See, and for me, that scene, I'm watching that, and it's not, I'm not chuckling at it. I'm going, this guy is fucking crazy.
Well,
you know?
I mean, it's an uneasy chuckle for me, because it's just, you know, what else am I going to do? I can't scream. You know, it's got those moments in it. I mean, like, some of, Josh Brolin's dialogue with Kelly MacDonald, where it's all like, you know, where'd you get that gun? You know, got it from the getting place. Where are you, Ben? You don't need to know everything, Carla Jean. And I don't know. To me, like, some of the chuckles is in the dialogue. And I don't know. I mean,
not for me at all.
I really, 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 really enjoy this movie a lot. And I watched it 3 times since last week.
Yeah, I think generally you can go and look at some Coen Brothers movies and most Coen Brothers movies and at least chuckle at a few bits. And I think in that one, for me, was just chuckling going on.
Dude, what about the deputy? There's a lot of chuckling with that guy, I thought. I mean, am I wrong, Christopher? I mean, he's like, oh, hell. You know, we just missed him, Sheriff. And it's like, what are we going to do? Put on LPVs looking for a man, just drink milk? I mean,
not at all. Let me tell you why that's funny. I mean, I think we talked last week about why this film resonates with me. And, this is my 17th year in the classroom. So, I'm starting to get more and more like Tommy Lee Jones' character every single day. Uh-huh. Not a day goes by I don't have to say, well, what do you want me to do? Arrest everybody who has milk?
Yeah.
You know, so, oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny in its own terms. And I think if you're a man of that age, which I seem to be, you know, there's recognition humor in there, too.
Yeah. And I don't know. I really, 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 really enjoy this movie. And we talked a lot about it last week. And I just, I feel like maybe I shouldn't this week. And maybe I should. But so much I like about this movie. That's why I put it at my number 3. So I guess that brings us on to your number 4, Christopher.
Yeah. Well, you know, looking at this list, this one seems like an odd choice for number 4, because if you mentioned if an alien came and you wanted to introduce them to the Coen brothers, I think the one film that you would have to show them is my number 4 pick, Fargo.
That's my number 4 as well.
It's my number because, 2, actually.
I love Fargo. Mm-hmm.
Because it's at 4, it goes without saying. I think they've done films that are purely better than that.
Yep.
But I don't think they've ever done a film that just combines everything that they do well to that degree. You know, you have some really, really funny moments.
Mm-hmm.
But I tell you why I think maybe it's a different kind of funny than you get some of their other films. You guys correct me if I'm wrong. Every single laugh you get in there is something that is 100% organic to the characters.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Like
for instance, maybe this is just me. One of the films that always just kills me is when Steve Buscemi is in the celebrity room trying to impress a prostitute.
Oh, yeah.
And
that
he gets off
me up.
And he gets off that line, well, you got Jose Feliciano, you got no complaints.
Yeah.
And it's hilarious, and it's totally something that guy would say.
Yeah, and for me, that the reason I love that movie, obviously it's my number 2, is just how really, while making that movie and you know, getting all those actors together and it being the quintessential, quote, Coen Brothers movie that it is, is you have them blatantly lying to you at the beginning of the movie.
Oh, yeah.
And the Coen Brothers don't care. They're like, so what?
It's a fucking movie.
It's a movie, and we're lying to you.
Get over it.
To the point of where they William H. Macy, who is amazing in that. I love him in that movie.
I do too.
I'm so glad you brought him up. I'll talk about him in a second.
He goes up to the Coens. Oh, they're making the movie, saying, "Well, can I get some information on the real guy on the case file?" And they go, "There is no real guy."
Yeah.
I was like, but you said that it's based on a real thing. Yeah, we lied.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay. And it's one of those movies that with the notion of, oh, it's based on a true story, that you watch the movie going, this is freaking ridiculous.
No
wow,
way.
This really fucking happened? And then it's like, no, it didn't happen. And they let you in on the joke, but they don't let you in on the joke, you know? And it's sort of the Coens way, the Coens having one over on the audience, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an amazing, amazing, amazing movie. It's such a great elements of tall tales, and so the modern tall tale in it is great. Because I mean, there's Babe the Blue Ox and Paul Bunyan, you know, that whole business with Fargo, and it's one of those things that's just so ridiculous that you're watching this just with that preface of it's a true story.
Like,
it
no
just
way. Turn
if they didn't do that at the beginning, I think it makes an entirely different movie.
One other thing I wanted to say about it is I guess all of us, we've been talking about the gift that the Coens have for bringing real pathos out in a character.
Oh yeah.
And with the possible exception of the central guy in A Serious Man.
Yeah.
Do you ever feel sorrier for any character in the entire Coen Brothers body of work than you do for William H. Macy when he's trying to get the ice off his windshield?
Yes.
I
that whole scene, I think, to me embodies his whole him throughout the whole movie, you know.
He's stuck.
He's stuck doing this little thing, chipping away at this big thick thing of ice. He's in way over his head. And he just can't do anything but sort of throw a little tantrum and then go back to it, you know?
You almost have to have a little bit more sympathy for his wife.
Yeah.
Almost. But at the same time, he's a sympathetic character that does bad shit, like really bad shit. And, you know, he's responsible for lots of bad shit happening. But you feel bad for the guy. I mean, that's acting. That's screenwriting. That's a really good thing. And
talk about unconventional heroes, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you have
Frances McDormand
is wonderful in that
as
Margie. And she's pregnant throughout the whole thing, and you know,
it's
she
so
is
cool
obviously
that she never has the baby too.
Yeah,
that's
and
so
you
cool.
watch this movie and you're like going, okay, she is just not what you picture as a protagonist in any kind of a movie, and she is so much more masculine than any other cop character at the very least, or almost any other character in the movie other than the bad guys, I guess.
They're fucking idiots.
And she's more competent than anyone else. She's smarter than everyone else, and her husband. I forget the actor's name.
John Carroll Lynch.
John Carroll Lynch is in there as this just such a feminine character.
Oh, he's
you know, and you know it's just
he's also such a good dude.
Yeah,
Norm. I mean, I just wanted to give Norm a hug all the way through that movie. Just such a good dude.
I
love how they're always eating. That's nothing to do with the movie, but I just got such a kick out of that.
Sure, and. Yeah, I love it. I'm sorry to hijack that from you, Christopher, but I love that movie.
We said something about a couple of movies. Maybe you might think about showing your parents. And Fargo's one of those movies, but you know, I don't expect them to take it well. But you know, they're grown-ups. I mean, it's such a good movie. I think it's their most. And man, am I saying this with a weird taste in my mouth, that it's probably one of their most universal movies. I mean, it's so oddball, but I do think that people can really get it. But at the same time, with it being a universal, so universal, a lot of people have seen it. And one of the things that frustrates me to no end about that movie is, like, the number one complaint I heard about it was the scene with Margie and her high school friend,
right?
And people say, you know, that's absolutely pointless to the movie. It shouldn't have been in there. I don't know why they left it in there. They, you know, it should have been cut. I could not disagree with the statement more.
Me too.
I mean, that movie, it shows that Margie is more than she seems.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows how quick thinking she is. It shows how moral she is. I think that's like one of the best.
I think it lends credence to this reality that the movie is creating.
I mean, it's just like, there's just so much stuff about this movie that, I mean, it's little stuff, but it really adds up to me. It's like I said before, you know, Margie's pregnant, but she never has the baby. Mm-hmm. I mean, how many movies or actresses are going to be brave enough to go through all the effort of making a character look pregnant, seem pregnant, you know, go through the prosthetics and the throwing up scenes to not really have any real story element to it? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just part of her strength. It's the... I don't remember the actor's name. I don't remember the character's name of the bad guy that wasn't Steve Buscemi. That guy. Mm-hmm. He is a, you know, a Anton Chigurh light.
Yeah.
Because he is a immoral, heartless, thoughtless character. But he's a doofus, unlike Chigurh. And I don't know. I'm in love with that movie.
Peter Stormare. That's
there you
his
go.
Name.
Peter Stormare.
It was on the tip of my brain. Okay.
Yeah. And I don't know. There's just like so
and
much.
He does a great job because he's so unsettling.
Yeah, and he's so
he's kind of funny looking, you know.
Yeah, and... he's kind of funny looking, you know. But that was Steve Buscemi mm-hmm. was the funny looking one, wasn't he?
Just yeah. generally funny.
And what about
just generally funny looking?
What about those stupid?
He was the big fella.
What about those stupid bitches?
the two prostitutes.
God. I mean. Yeah. Sure. He's kind of funny looking. Yeah, I'm enamored with this movie. I love this movie. I think it came up on our crime movies, but I'm bringing it up again.
Sure. It's amazing. It's just one of those movies that I personally love just unconditionally,
yeah.
and it's just so wonderful.
If somebody says they don't like it, I like them a little bit less because
I poke them in the eye out of just, you know, reflex.
That's just like one of those movie fan things that just drives me up the fucking walls when people attack that scene with Linda and the Mike, whatever his name was. But yeah.
Yamagita.
Yeah, there
Mike
you go.
Yamagita.
Mike Yamagita. Love it. I'm sorry, but please, now that we're done hijacking you, you can continue if you want.
Oh, I think I made my 2 points, so I think we're ready to move on.
Wonderful, wonderful movie. And that brings us down to Ethan's number three, right?
I don't think we've had your number four yet, dude.
My number four. Yeah, it was Fargo.
Oh, it was Fargo?
Yep.
Okay, well.
Oh, wait a minute. Let me make sure.
Is it?
I'm pretty sure
because
it was.
This was his number four.
Yes, it's my number four.
So it's your number four as well. So it's to my number three.
Yep.
And we've been talking some of their affinity with comedy, and I think one of their movies that is just I think more a comedy than anything else is to me is The Lady Killers.
Great movie. That's my number two.
And that's one movie that you know you sort of see the trailer for it, and you sort of get the rundown of what the movie is, and I don't really buy it being a Coen Brothers movie at that point. Then you go see it and go,
oh yeah,
well fuck, okay, And it's the Coen Brothers doing a heist movie, and it, you know, it's where you have a heist movie doing this, doing that. This is the Coen Brothers twist on it, where they throw in these absolutely fascinating characters, and this absolutely just wonderful interaction between everybody, and this sort of mayhem that goes on with this outlandish character in Tom Hanks, and an equally outlandish character with the old lady.
I watched, okay, first off, this is my number two, so I have to talk about it now instead of later. I have two main reactions to this movie. My first one is I cannot believe how underrated it is. Mm-hmm. I think it's amongst their best work. I think it's really funny. I think a lot of it's really, really good. And I see three performances in that movie that I think got fucking robbed of Oscar nominations. Mm-hmm. The one that I will concede is Tom Hanks.
Sure.
If Tom Hanks wasn't Tom Hanks and already has his Oscars and considered the golden boy of the world,
right?
Except
for Paul, right?
You know, except for Paul, but he should have gotten an Oscar nomination. But because of his past successes, I understand him not getting it. The other one, I think the J.K. Simmons got fucking robbed of a he deserved a nomination for Best Supporting Actor. I'm not saying I think he deserved the Oscar, but he deserved some sort of recognition for that role.
Oh, yeah.
And the other one, and I can't even remember her name, was the old lady.
Mm-hmm.
She was phenomenal in that movie. And I think she should have won the fucking Oscar, and I don't care what she was up against. I don't know care who won. I thought she was that good, she deserved recognition for that role. And I love this movie. And Tom Hanks cracks me up in that movie. Same thing with J.K. Simmons. You know, couldn't be easier. Mm-hmm. Oh, IBS, Mountain Girl.
Yeah, and for me, that movie is sort of the Coen Brothers do Ocean's 11.
Well,
instead of having these super slick, smart, and cunning guys doing it, you have these
idiots,
inept criminals planning this heist. And they have a good plan, but they're just so always stumbling over each other. They have to deal with this old lady, and then they're always fighting amongst each other, even and trying to go behind each other's backs, and that just screws them all out of everything.
Have you noticed how in their? In their ensemble movies, you know, you have your. No Country for Old Men, your Fargo, your Lady Killers, how they always have this group of fucking idiots, and yet there's always one person in that group that's scary and incredibly competent. And you had that with the Japanese guy or Chinese, the Asian guy in Lady Killers, and you had Sugar and, you know, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, I just think that's weird that they put up these ensembles of idiots and they have somebody that's, you know, heads and shoulders above average person.
I think even the Asian guy, and it's a bit of a joke, too.
He is, though, because he's Asian.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that Asian people are jokes, but I think that is the joke.
Sure.
You know, that he's the Asian guy, so of course he knows fucking karate and all this, and he kills people that try to rob him, and I don't know. I love that movie. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Great. Christopher, have you seen that one?
Yes, and it's actually number. I've seen them. I've seen all their films multiple times. Well, yeah, and it's number nine on my list. And I tell you what I like about it is, you know, I honestly don't think of it as a heist movie. You're absolutely right to call it that. Not disagreeing with you there.
Sure.
But if it were just a heist movie, I don't think I would regard it to the degree I do.
Yeah.
I like it for a lot of the same reasons that I like A Simple Man. A Simple Man is unapologetically Jewish in an age where Hollywood and all movies in general either have nothing to say about religion or it's just absolutely juvenile and puerile.
Yeah.
But here's a film that just embraces a specific faith and a specific moment. And, you know, there's that huge element from the music to, like you said, the central character in Lady Killers of embracing the traditional, you know, black Southern Protestant churches and everything that goes along with them.
Mm-hmm.
And showing, you know, and again, you know, I've never really understood why they get accused of being nihilists, because there's a strong moral sense to this movie.
Mm-hmm.
There is a supernatural hand looking out for this good, devout, and faithful woman.
Mm-hmm. And when the bad guys fail, they fail epically.
Yep.
Absolutely, absolutely. No matter how charming or funny they are, you know,
they're bad people.
Yeah. Now, but I tell you, the reason that I knocked it down as far as I did, because I think we're about seven or eight spots way on our rating.
Yeah.
Okay. Sure. I gotta ding them down because it's a remake.
Yeah.
The original's fantastic.
It's a remake of a film that doesn't need to be made. And to me, as people as spectacularly talented as the Coen brothers, them remaking a film that doesn't need to be remade. Guess what other film didn't make my top 10?
Yeah.
Is just a waste of ultimately a waste.
See, and I kind of like it. I mean, if people like the Coen brothers are going to remake a movie, I'm cool with that. That makes me curious instead of, you know, Joe Blow off the Hollywood bus getting to remake, you know, fucking Wizard of Oz or something like that. I mean, the Lady Killers and the True Grits are, you know, they're very good movies, but because it's the Coen brothers, it makes me curious.
Sure.
And I really like it. And I'm ashamed to admit that I saw this before I saw the original.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, I probably would like it less had I seen the original first.
Right.
But I did really, really, really like this one a lot. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, as much as I love the Coen brothers, I can't exempt them from my remake policy. And it's like, why remake good films? There are so many almost good films out there that you know, could, with a more talented filmmaker, a more generous budget, a better actor, could be pushed into the great realm.
Sure.
You know, why aren't people remaking mediocre? Well, okay, excuse me. They are remaking mediocre films. It's just they tend to make them worse.
Yeah.
Imagine
but,
that.
But, you know, I would rather go for the almost, you know, let's do them first before we put out three new versions of Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. To me, this is just, I don't know. To me, it just feels like such a different movie that I'm okay with it. I mean, it's not a shot for shot remake. I mean, it doesn't even feel like the same kind of movie. So I don't know. I mean, but I really, really, really like it. And I think that I do think it doesn't get enough credit for what it is, because I do think there's some really good stuff going on in it.
We agree there.
So I guess that brings us down to your number three, Christopher.
Yeah, and wow, I'm really, really shocked looking at this list, because this was my number one for, God, 15 years, and it was my number two up until about 5 minutes before we went on the air.
Okay.
So much to my surprise, Barton Fink is only number three for me.
You know, that's a sin of omission on my list. As much as I love it, I wanted to talk about some of these others more because I felt really safe that you were bringing.
And I haven't seen Barton Fink actually.
It's a great one. Go
ahead. Well, I tell you, Barton Fink and I made our acquaintance when I was, believe it or not, horribly writer's blocked on a project.
Oh wow!
You know? Yeah, I mean, it was something that I did. It sounded like it might be fun, but I have to admit the money was the main thing drawing me into it.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I have this tendency to where if I'm writing, I know some people write to music. I like having films on in the background. I like hearing dialogue and voices and things like that.
Yeah.
And it just so happened that our pay channels were running Barton Fink like three times a day the entire time that I was writer's blocked. And it was like, you know, my initial reaction was, oh, my God, someone's filming my life. And then the more you watch it, the more you find the layers, the more that you really start to hate the central character. Wow. You know, the more I realize that when I'm old, I'm probably going to turn into the William Faulkner-esque writer guy, Bill Mayhew.
Right.
You know, I mean, and honestly, if anybody who's ever gotten an email from me knows that for the past, God, ever since I've had email, my signature file is look upon, my SIG file has always read, look upon me, I'll show you the life of the mind.
Right on.
So, I mean, and then when you just think this film can't show you anything else, it becomes screamingly funny when the two cops wander in and start interrogating Barton.
Yeah. I mean, just,
you know,
I mean, Like, how great was John Goodman in that?
Cannot discount him. But, you know, just bottom line for me is I don't think there's ever been a better film made about the creative process. And as somebody that's written my whole life and been blessed enough to do it professionally, it's just a film that speaks to me on such a level. I honestly don't know how universal the message is. I mean, it was up for a ton of Oscars and everything just on its own merits.
Yeah.
But, you know, just for the degree it speaks to me, I'm surprised I have it as low as I do.
Yeah. No, it's a good one. No, it's a major sin of omission on my list. I really, 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 really like that movie, and you totally need to check it out, Ethan. I don't think it's on Netflix, but it's totally worth the rent. That brings us down to my number three. My number three was No Country for Old Men, so I've already talked to that, so let's go ahead and move right on to Ethan's number two.
My number two was Fargo.
Okay, that brings us down to your number two, Christopher.
All right, well.
Damn, you have to go again.
Yes. I still am a little bit shocked that that this passed Barton Fink, but I'm going to try to defend my choice, if nothing else, to myself.
Okay.
But number two is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And I'll tell you why I love this. Okay.
Number nine.
Okay. Maybe to a degree. Now that I think about it, maybe to a degree even better than Fargo. Here's something where you're weaving together everything that the Coens do well, because you know it's howlingly funny. It, you know, you actually do get some genuine pathos to the end where, you know, Everett is facing the loss of his wife.
Yep.
You know, it has their great moral sense to it that I can't understand why people miss. And it also integrates the music to a degree that Fargo does not.
Yeah.
I mean, we've come to think of especially the later period Coen Brothers films as having these great T-Bone Burnett soundtracks. Well, quite frankly, there's never been a better Coen Brothers soundtrack than that one.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah.
Wonderful soundtrack.
And you gentlemen were nice enough to let me get on my soapbox for No Country last time. So, okay, here we go. Here's my soapbox moment for this show.
Okay.
Okay. Now, I've grown up in the rural South my entire life. It's just been different areas of rural. Okay. Now, I'm not saying that we haven't deserved most of what we've gotten. But I think the portrayal of the rural South has long since gone past its usefulness, portraying us as racist, inbred moron teabaggers.
Sure.
Okay. And I have to admit, nothing scared me more than these two smart Alex from Minnesota making a movie about the South.
Yeah.
Because I'm thinking, oh my God, this is going to be something I'm going to revile. But it's such an honest and yet affectionate portrayal of what it's like to be in the rural South. I mean, yeah, it's technically set in the Depression, but for somebody who's been there his whole life, I had no trouble recognizing any of these characters. I mean, and it does it doesn't ignore anything. I mean, you know, you do have the dancing, singing Klansmen trying to lynch one of the main characters.
Yeah.
But you know, they're such a relatively small part of the movie compared to the other people that you meet. And that's been my experience in the South. I have met 100 times many more wonderful, generous, sweet people like Tim Blake Nelson's character than I ever have met people that are hardcore prejudice,
sure,
or prejudice to any degree. And to me, it's such an affectionate tribute to an area that doesn't get a whole lot of love from Hollywood.
Yeah.
You know, that part of it really spoke to me as well.
I could see that. My thing about O Brother Where Art Thou, and once again, it's just going to come down to, I put on my number 9 because you cannot discount O Brother Where Art Thou. I mean, it's such a wonderful movie. It's so unique. At the same time, because it's, you know, based off the Odyssey, you know, people are going to walk into it like, ha ha ha, this is going to be great because it's made out about the Odyssey, but it's set in the South and they sing on the radio and it's going to be so funny. And you get like this, you know, once again, there's this, you know, I'm complaining about a minority here, but you get this subset of people with O Brother Where Art Thou that just don't get it. And everything you said about this movie is so true. Ethan and I, we're in Kansas, and our biggest claim to fame movie-wise is, you know, Wizard of Oz, or on TV, what was that show that had the mountains in Lawrence, Kansas? You know,
Jericho.
Jericho Supernatural.
And Supernatural. So, I mean, I get that, you know, the whole thing with these stereotypes just being perpetuated by, you know, motion pictures. At the same time, I understand why it happens, but it is always nice to see them get their bone, and that was something I recognized about this movie. And at the same time, I don't get those people that walk in thinking that this is just a comedy. I hate that discount of this movie. I mean, there are people that think that it's nothing but a funny movie, and it's even funnier because George Clooney lip syncs poorly. And I have no tolerance for that train of thought with this movie because there is so much going on here, and I find it unfortunate. So it's my number 9, and I'm really glad that you can take as much out of it as you do. It'd probably be higher on my list if I came from the South, but I don't come from the South that you're talking about, at least. So.
Well, on a lot of days, you can count your blessings there.
Yeah. Bringing us down to my number 2. My number 2, we've already discussed. I already brought it up. It's The Lady Killers. So I think at this point that takes us to Ethan's number 1.
Yeah, my number 1's Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Is it?
I absolutely love that one.
I think it's really great.
Being a fan of sort of Greek mythology and whatnot, I thought the way that these guys tackled this in such an oddball way was just refreshing for me, and it's one of those movies that really struck a chord with me. And when I first saw it, I was just enamored with it, and
sure,
it easily fell into my number 1 spot just because it just hit every single chord with me that I like, and it's got a great it's obviously a great story being the Odyssey, and
sure,
it was just such a different, unique way of doing it, and I loved the way the Coen brothers can do this off the wall type of a movie about the South. I mean, you hit it already on that. You know, it's these guys from Minnesota doing a movie about the Deep South, and in the, you know, Deep South in the Depression, you know, and you have just this absolute affinity for I think what's at the heart of the Odyssey myth for me, in these characters, and in the Odysseus character, and with George Clooney, I loved it. So I mean, hit my number 1 without effort for me.
Cool. No, it is. It's a really, really good movie. I love it. And you know, that's the thing about this, making this list. Was, you know, there are so many of these movies that I have so much affection for, it's so hard to put them in some kind of order.
Yeah.
So, no, it's a good choice, and good job, Ethan. Good choice. Now that brings us down to Christopher. What's your number 1?
No Country for Old Men, and I don't know what else I can say about it that I didn't say last week, but you know, it's just honestly, I, you know, just the great moral questions that it raises to me, and the way that they do it, And the way that so many people misinterpret this film, I feel more compelled. It's funny, if you know, it's a Best Picture winner, and I have this extra compulsion to defend it, like it needs further validation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but there's just so many people that fundamentally you know, misread this film, because I've had a bunch of my friends say, oh, what was your number one on that Supernatural show? And you know, it leads to conversations about, I tell them, well, it was No Country for Old Men, and there's just this reflexive, ooh, it's so violent and dark, and yes, but you've completely missed the point. Now please let me entertain you for the next 30 minutes about how you missed the point.
Yeah, right.
So I don't know, maybe that's what propelled it so far up the list for me, but honestly, after last week, I'd feel like a bit of a hypocrite if I didn't put it number one.
Well, you know, at the same time, I would too, but I put it down at my number four. But, you know, I have a lot to say about everything. So, yeah. I mean, I don't really feel like I have to justify not having it at my number one. But, no, it's a fantastic movie. I said last week, and I said it again, and I'll keep saying it. It's one of those DVDs that I inexplicitly, or whatever the word, inexplicably keep revisiting. I watch this movie so often. I mean, it's and it's such a strange comfort movie, because you know, I often, like, I have nothing else to watch. Why don't I watch? There's this horrible things going on and blah blah blah. But I don't know. I to me, there's always something to take out of it. You know, it's not one of those background movies for me. I sit down and I watch the hell out of it. You know, I mean, I'm looking at every detail and I'm really enjoying it. So cool. No, I'm not surprised that you're number one at all. Coming down to my number one, I'm going to fully admit that I've listed off some movies here that are definitely fundamentally better movies than my number one. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, it's once again, I don't know what's coming out of me, but sometimes I have this need to back the underdog, and I think that you cannot have a bigger Coen Brothers movie underdog than The Hudsucker Proxy, which is my number one. My thing about that is that movie fucking tanked with a passion in the theaters. Luckily, this is not one that I've run into people with a lot of venom for, because that would infuriate me probably more than a lot of movies, because to me, it's just such a fundamentally sweet and classic movie. I mean, it's obviously the Coen brothers taking on a Frank Capra movie. Mm-hmm. I love so much about this movie. I mean, let's get it out of the way. Paul Newman was brilliant in it. I love Paul Newman. And like, listen back to our all of our podcasts or whatever, but you'll catch me a lot saying, sure, sure. And I took that from Paul Newman in The Hudsucker Proxy, and it's mm-hmm. become part of my everyday vernacular. I say, sure, sure, because I thought it was funny. Bruce fucking Campbell as Smitty cracked me the hell up. That's one of the better chapters in his autobiography of Chinsky Kill, when he's talking about his development of that character and how they decided he's a hat guy. And my thing about this movie is, you know, I keep saying, like, you know, like robbed people getting robbed of Oscar nominations. I cannot beat the drum more that I think that Jennifer Jason Leigh was absolutely robbed of any recognition for that movie. I thought she was brilliant in that movie. One of these days, we're going to end up doing a top six film performances of all time, our top six favorite, and she will be on that list. I'll throw out that spoiler right now. Tim Robbins was wonderful in it. Tim Robbins is such a weird guy, like, especially off camera. You know, he had that whole thing going on with Susan Sarandon, and he's a hippie, and, you know, he's an Oscar winner now, and he was excellent in Mystic River and probably deserved that Oscar and all that stuff. But he was playing such a sweet, innocent character that becomes, corrupted by the situation around him. Mm-hmm. And yet, like, that core goodness to him, you know, brings him through, and he does the right thing in the end. There's the wonderful things going on with, like, the angels and the devil with Bill Cobb, and I don't remember the name of the bald guy that was the bad guy. You had that going on. You know, the whole, you know, for kids with the what do they call it, the Hudsucker, but the hula hoop. No, they end up calling it the hula hoop. Mm-hmm. I love this movie, and it makes me sad that more people don't love it, because it's one of those movies that I just watch it with a smile on my face from beginning to end, and it's my favorite Coen Brothers movie. And like I said, I think that they've had better cinematic achievements, but I think I just enjoy this one the most.
And the reason it actually did not make my list, and the reason is because I don't remember it too well. And I didn't want to put it on there and not do it
that
justice.
That's on Netflix.
Yeah, I know.
And I watch it often, actually.
And, it was either watch that or watch one I hadn't seen. So I was Blood Simple? I watched Blood Simple
That's
instead.
A good one, too.
So for Hudsucker Proxy, the reason it didn't make my list is because it's not that familiar to me in my mind anymore. And I didn't want to do it in any injustice by saying, you know, oh, it's my number four because I remember it being kind of good. But that's about as much as I could say about it.
I'm a big sucker for the classic movies. Mm-hmm. And I think listening to this damn show, you'll figure that out. But, you know, I love the old Frank Capra movies. Mm-hmm. And, I love this. I mean, and also, granted, it's before it, but this is the same people that made No Country for Old Men and Fargo and this deep, hardcore, bad stuff happening, and they make this movie. And to me, and I'm probably way off base, but to me, this is the closest thing they've ever come to having a love letter to movies. And, you know, they really embrace that era of, you know, I keep going back there, the Frank Capra movies with the miracles happening and the otherworldly involvement with God and blah, blah, blah. But, you know, fundamentally, it's an old school Hollywood movie, and I just wish people liked it more than they did because I love it.
Sure.
So that's why I picked it for my number one. Have you seen it, Christopher?
I've seen all their films several times.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. And it made number 10 on my list, you know, so I get, you know, and I agree with a lot of what you said. It's got so many of the best elements of a Coen movie. It's a film that unapologetically talks about
it's a benevolent isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, but you know, I mean, it's willing to tell you there's a transcendent benevolent morality. It does so in a very funny way, but you know, it's an element that I treasure in films the less and less I see it as time has gone on. It's as far as quotability, I think it's severely underrated.
Yep. You know, for kids.
You forgot about the mezzanine.
Yeah,
not counting the mezzanine. You know, that aspect of it works. You know, in most cases, one of their better cast films. I mean, landing Paul Newman, that's got to be a coup for any film.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Charles Durning is always delightful. Mm-hmm. I mean, I, between that and his role in The Governor and Oh Brother, he's great. Jennifer Jason Leigh nails her character, as you said.
Amazing.
Yeah, but this is just me. You know, if you're not
a sucker for, you know, the old Capra movies and stuff like I am. So
no,
it makes sense.
No, excuse me, sir. You are talking to a man who has shown Mr. Smith Goes to Washington to every single government class I've taught in the last 17 years.
Yeah, but it's a Wonderful Life, you know.
Well, if I could fit that into the curriculum and not get fired, I'd show that too.
Okay.
But this is what to me keeps it from being high, higher on the list. And this is a totally subjective thing. I will grant you. The one thing in that film that does not work for me is Tim Robbins.
Really?
Yes.
See, I thought he anchored that movie.
Well, it's not a terrible performance. It isn't. Please don't think it isn't like a Sofia Coppola in Godfather 3 type performance.
Dad.
Yeah. But that's the one thing that has to totally 100% work all the time, and he just doesn't quite sell it enough for me. And again, it's a Coen Brothers film, better than 95% of the films ever made. Mm-hmm. But just he seems to be the one person that I can think of in any Coen Brothers film that seems miscast to me. And again, it may be just a personal thing. I just have a tough time buying Tim Robbins as a Rube.
See, and I thought you're right, it is subjective because, you know, I thought that, you know, he really, really sold it. And like some of like the I'm looking over that fourth wall, and I understand some of the stuff that, you know, Tim Robbins is a very public dude, and he does a lot of really publicly irritating stuff, and a lot of people find him obnoxious. And to me, casting him as that Rube was funny. You know, it's like casting George Clooney as the idiot, or Brad Pitt as the idiot that, you know, befriends the weird lady at the gym. I mean, it's breaking those preconceived notions that you have of a person, and you're putting them in this role that they're totally wrong for, that makes it work in my mind, and I'm completely probably wrong. But I love that movie. I thought that he anchored it, but it was kind of like in that ironic way. It's like, you know, of course Tim Robbins isn't a rube. That's why it's so funny. Yeah. You know, like
Okay. I will throw up one other bit of objective proof.
Okay.
You will notice that there are only two leading men the Coen brothers never worked with again. And their problems with Nicolas Cage are well documented. Never had Tim Robbins back. So that kind of makes me think maybe I wasn't the only one disappointed with the results.
And you know what? At the same time, yeah, maybe I'm sure the Coen brothers were disappointed with. I'm not saying otherwise, but at the same time, the Coen brothers are making studio movies, and they say, well, he was in the Hudsucker Proxy, so obviously it was his fault. You know, you have that kind of bullshit politics going on. But, you know, and like you said, it is subjective, and I just really like, and I think that more people should check it out, because I do think it's really, 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 really good.
And I would say that about all their films.
Well, yeah, me too. But I think this is one that a lot of people have overlooked. So,
and really, it is totally worth your time to see.
I think I could not agree more. I love it. I think it's a lot of fun. But yeah, that makes my number one is the Hudsucker Proxy. At this point, I guess we are going to run down our top 10 and stick a pin in it. Ethan, what's your number 10?
Well, my number 10 ended up being Blood Simple. Number nine's True Grit. Number eight's Burn After Reading. Number seven was Miller's Crossing. Number six, The Big Lebowski. Number five, Intolerable Cruelty. Number four, No Country for Old Men. Number three, The Lady Killers. Number two, Fargo. And number one, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Cool. Christopher.
Well, I had Hudsucker Proxy at number 10. I had Lady Killers at number 9. 8 was Raising Arizona. Doesn't it seem stunning that we never got around to that one on any of our top sixes?
That's another sin of omission for me.
Yeah, wow.
And for me, they just had so many other better movies for me.
Yeah.
But it's very much worthy of discussion, though, I find. Go ahead.
Yeah. And number 7, Miller's Crossing. Oh God, how can we just tell people go see Miller's Crossing? Even though we didn't really talk about it, go see that too.
Yeah.
And then 6, A Serious Man, 5, Big Lebowski, 4, Fargo, 3, Barton Fink, 2, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, number 1, No Country for Old Men.
Excellent. And once again, I agree with 1990s Miller's Crossing. That's a movie that has a little bit of a personal thing with me. I showed that movie to my girlfriend Rachel, and I think we were 10, 15 minutes into it. She's like, good God, this movie sucks, and I hate it, and I don't want to watch it. I'm like, do I have to break up with this chick? Because this movie's awesome. And then, you know, we got further into it, and she ended up really digging it. So, but it's if there's a movie that I honestly feel that we skirted over and didn't give the credit, it's Miller's Crossing, because it's wonderful.
Can we say best plot of any of their movies?
Oh, without a doubt. Without a doubt. That brings me down to my number 9 of Oh Brother, Art Thou. My number 8 is A Serious Man. And I think I finally found the one that Ethan hated, which was The Man Who Wasn't There.
I can't stand that one.
I think it's so weird. I mean, I have to keep going back to that dumbass W word. But it's one of I didn't like it the first time I saw it. But, you know, just, I don't know, there's just some weird things about it. I think it's interesting to watch. So it's my number 7. And then we get into the list I've already discussed. Number 6, Lebowski. Number 5, Burn After Reading. Number 4, Fargo. Number 3, No Country for Old Men. Number 2 is Lady Killers. And my number 1 was Hudsucker Proxy. Looking at my list, I probably sort of swapped Lady Killers and No Country for Old Men. But, yep, that's our list. Coen Brothers are excellent filmmakers, and I like watching anything that they make. So I think this is a blast, and I do think that we're going to be able to perpetuate this, and we can talk this with any directors.
And I'll close with, as far as Coen Brothers, it's not something that I can go into viewing lightly. It's something that you have to sit down and watch.
Yep.
And, you know, so many times there are movies out there where, you know, you could put them on as background noise, and I don't think any of their movies fall into that category for me.
Not for me either.
Yeah.
Not for me either. But I think they're wonderful, and I will literally see anything they do. Anything that they do. I don't care if they're remaking.
See, I'm not quite to that point.
I'm at least intrigued to see what they do. That's the thing about them is I just find everything they make so interesting. Whether it's good or not, whether it's good or bad, I find it interesting. You know, like Raising Arizona is an awful lot of fun, but it's one of their weaker movies, I think. maybe, but that's, you know, saying a lot. You know, I think we used the analogy last time. It's like, you know, your favorite orgasm. I mean, there's just so much good going on here, but there's a lot of obnoxious stuff going on with that movie, but I do find it interesting to watch, and I think that's something that the Coen brothers do well. So that brings an end to our discussion about the Coen brothers, of the directorial works they've done. If you haven't seen any of these movies, good God, people, go watch all of them, and I think that you're going to like at least some of them.
Yes. Transformers 3 will be there when you're done.
Yes,
go
it
watch
will.
Some good films.
Go watch some good films. But stay tuned. We're going to be right back with the outro section.
In constant sorrow all through his day.
We are back with our outro section. We just had a fascinating discussion about the Coen brothers. I think this director talk is going to work. How about you?
I think so, too. Yeah.
Very cool. It really opens up the floodgates of different people and discussions and shows that we can have.
Can I come back for the Ed Wood show?
Sure. I don't think I've seen 10 of his movies, but...
He did 10 movies?
Did he do 10 movies? Oh, surely he did. But I don't know. But
I don't know if I could sit through 10 of his movies.
Once again, man, those are interesting to watch. It's painful, but it's interesting. But yeah, it was a fun discussion. I had a lot of fun. And thank you once again, Christopher, for being on the show.
Definitely. It's always a pleasure to have you on.
Always a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you, guys. I very, very, very much appreciate this. This is such a great, great experience for me every time. Thank you.
Oh, good. I know I enjoy it, even if nobody else cares. But I enjoy I enjoy talking it because.
Same here.
It's fun to talk about stuff.
Yes, after this, Aaron, you go into the cage.
I'll go into the cage. Yeah. Aww. But yeah, we don't know what we're doing next week, and we're not going to pretend like we do.
Nope.
So we'll have it figured out by then. But yeah, we'll have it figured out by then. Do you have anything else to add, Ethan?
Not off the top of my head, no.
Christopher?
Thank you for listening.
Yep, thank you very much for listening. Until next week, I'm Aaron.
I'm Ethan.
Let your geek flag fly. We'll be right back.